with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, and welcome to the program. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. I just like that. It goes back to a recommendation from our YouTube archivist, Horst, who suggested Thorn in the Side Thursday, and dadgummit, if Friday on the Front Porch wasn't taken, Feather in the Cap Friday. Both of those come from, of course, Joseph Heller's classic Catch-22, in which, was it Colonel Cathcart, General Dreidel, or General P.P. Peckham, who was constantly, it was Colonel Cathcart, wasn't it? Because he wanted that general star who was constantly obsessing over things that were either thorns in the side or feathers in the cap. So it's Thorn in the Side Thursday. And I think you'll see why shortly. As I mentioned in the show post, sometimes, it feels a little bit like, in many ways, what we talk about here are little snapshots of the American experience, in large part. Of course, we look to the wider world as well, such as Victoria, Australia's pending dirty word ban. And I just want to see that, well, I want to see that one enforced. Just because there, you know, if I understand the colloquial, there's just so doggone many of them. And they're constantly evolving and being, and new ones are being made up. It's a veritable incubator over there. And a delightful one at that. So yeah, the scope is not always strictly American, but there are just so many stories out there right now that have a flavor of, or the ability to put together little tiny chips of culture into a larger mosaic. And because nothing particularly fits together tonight, That's sort of what this Thorn in the Side Thursday feels like for me. We'll see if it does for you as well. Glad to have you on board. Glad to have you along for the ride this evening. Cussing, discussing, like John says. Conversation radio. Never fear, the conversation is fine, and we've not lost a caller yet. That telltale thud and the fainting sound. Oh, nope, never had one of those yet. We've had phones dropped. I occasionally get little beeps in my ear because cell phones buttons are apparently easy to press when one is talking. But no losses. No losses. And a reminder, and I still have to get the schedule to News Ninja Susan. I'm sorry I've been delinquent in that regard. But just a reminder of what the schedule is like upcoming. To wit, next week, we will have a show Monday, which is June the 6th. Isn't it? Yep, 6th. There will be no show Tuesday, Wednesday, and probably not Thursday, and certainly not Friday. So next week is shot. So, too, is the following week, because that is the week that we get on the road and head for Netroots Nation in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hopefully there will be some broadcasting taking place from there But we're going to have to wait to see what the bandwidth is like and so forth. Sometimes there are issues. We'll see. And that will bring us home on the 20th. The 20th of June. That week after that, the 21st, the 22nd, the 23rd, 24th, normal. Show on the 27th. On the 28th, we pack up and head down to the campus of Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, for the PRISM West Virginia American History Academy. I'm excited about this the way kids get excited about a trip to the amusement park. Because just being able to dip my wiggling little toe back into academia and just sit there and revel in the pure search for and acquisition of knowledge is like, truly, it's like candy to me. It's brain candy. And what we'll have this year is an advancing into the early 19th century, which should just be amazing. Absolutely nothing short of amazing. And it's going to be intensive and long-term, beginning on the 29th and the 30th of June and the 1st of July. That's the first week of PRISM. Then comes the long 4th of July weekend. And then July 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th. And then another regular weekend. And then the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th. And every minute of every session will be brought to you live, right here on the horn, on our stream, as well as being brought to you live on our Ustream channel. The video will also be archived for your later viewing pleasure or edification. I encourage you to find time for all of it, whether you're involved in education or not, regardless of your educational level, regardless of whether you consider yourself a historian. Because there's going to be information here that you will not get elsewhere. And you will be, I hate the kind of eliminationist language, but I'm going to do it anyway. You will be armed to the teeth with factual historical information with which to refute any right-wing weirdo who may come down the pike saying, well, I remember, you know, we got to remember that the pioneers brought Jesus with them when they... When they drove their station wagons across the Continental Divide and up the Oregon Trail and the, you know, or, you know, when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor or the Jamestown Colony was founded in 1620 at the Plymouth Rock, you know, that kind of thing. When the shot heard round the world was fired in Concord, New Hampshire. Thank you, Michelle Bachmann. This is the only way to refute any of that. Oh, and by the way, backing up. The reason we're going to D.C. next week is for the purpose of defending the Environmental Protection Agency. Millions of dollars have been spent sleazing and sliming the EPA for daring, for having the unmitigated gall, the outright temerity to take little tiny baby steps toward protecting Appalachian people from the grim and rotten realities that are associated with mountaintop removal. So we're going to go and give them some props and back them up a little bit. There'll be a press conference about 10:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time in front of the EPA building. It's there at the, and the EPA is located right there where you get off the DC Metro at Federal Triangle. and like I said, press conference about 10:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And what you will hear there, because you will hear it. Aha! See? This is one of the missions of the horn. To eventually be able to leverage every bit of the front end of cutting-edge technology to make things happen in real time. And that will be the case in D.C. We will be shooting live video and sending it to the Horn's Ustream page, where you can watch. You'll hear some stirring words. It will also be archived and embeddable as well. And then a little bit later, there will be somewhat more high-quality video that will be edited into a larger piece. At the same time, of course, that we are in D.C., there will be a number of people marching in southern West Virginia. And they will be sort of reenacting, I suppose would be the best word, the march on Blair Mountain that took place 90 years ago. There's only one problem. 90 years ago, the march on Blair Mountain was a march for essential human rights for people, men and their families, who worked in brutal, hateful, oppressive, nightmarish conditions under the thumbs of a profit-driven coal industry that was positively soaked and sodden in blood and cared not a damn about human beings. It was said back then, and it was true, that the coal companies cared more about a bank mule than they did about a human being, because human beings would line up and work. There was always somebody standing there waiting for a job, but you had to go out and buy a good mule, and good mules didn't come cheap. Of course, it must be remembered that the miners in West Virginia took up arms against the coal company when they felt they could not tolerate it any longer. They had been harassed and deliberately pushed into violence, and they took the bait and fell for it. And they got their guns and started marching on Logan, West Virginia, and it culminated in a battle at Blair Mountain in which the full force and fury of the United States government, and as well as the state militia and state police and the coal company gun thugs, were brought to bear on those poor men who only wanted a decent wage. It must be remembered that they were crushed like bugs because they had adopted the use of violence. It must be remembered that the Battle of Blair Mountain is a monument to the futility of violence, because the beating that organized labor took at Blair Mountain was one that reverberated throughout Appalachia and killed organized labor stone stump dead until a piece of legislation was passed in the FDR administration, the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, that allowed labor a chance to organize on at least somewhat of a level footing with management. And that's the history. Fast forward to 2011. As you know, because we have talked about it on a number of occasions, mountaintop removal in Appalachia has destroyed over 500 mountains. It has buried in excess of 1,000, 1,500 miles, perhaps 2,000 miles of what were once beautiful mountain streams. An area of Appalachia the size of the entire state of Delaware or more has been forever destroyed. And in the destruction, massive toxins and poisons have been let loose into the air and the water that have turned pockets of Appalachia into little cancer incubator communities. Some of you may not like this, but the truth must be told. Who's doing some of that? The United Mine Workers of America. Because, see, it doesn't say on your UMWA card whether or not you work on a mountaintop removal job or whether or not you work honorably underground. It just says you're a card-carrying member. When the United Mine Workers agreed to admit mountain removers to their ranks, they abandoned, you see, the high ground that they had taken in their long struggle for rights and justice. They abandoned it. They walked away from it. And that high ground is now occupied by the people I describe as the hardest working, bravest people I know. The folks, among other groups, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, by Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, by Southern Appalachian Mountain Stewards, and many other organizations fighting, struggling for essential human rights for all Appalachian people, not just a little handful of demolitions experts who ruin the lives of thousands and thousands of others. And so it is that this March on Blair Mountain must be remembered not as a commemoration of unionism, but as a present manifestation of the absolute determination to end once for all and forever mountaintop removal, and to extend that ban to all forms of surface mining that plagues every community wherever it may go, even as far as you may recall, even as far as Inner Mongolia. So as we go to D.C., they will be marching. And I would simply advise you, or suggest to you, that as you pay, it's getting a lot of, this march on Blair is getting a lot of publicity. But remember, this is not about the UMWA. Because at this point in time, the UMWA is a part of the problem, not a part of the solution. The UMWA is actively involved in poisoning, blasting, and destroying out of hand entire communities, entire mountains, entire streams in Appalachia. There's about 1,000 UMWA members working on mountaintop removal sites. And they have abandoned any pretext of working for any sort of justice, because you cannot blow up mountains. You cannot destroy communities. You cannot bury streams. You cannot poison the water with which children bathe and brush their teeth. You cannot do those things and claim to be involved in anything resembling justice. The UMWA is morally and ethically bankrupt. And the only reason that the UMWA leadership adopted mountaintop removal is because it protected its leadership's cushy existence. And understand, it gives me pain to say these things, because I am the son of a union miner. I am the grandson of a union miner. I am a nephew of a union miner. And I am the great-grandson of a union miner. My darling wife, Agnes, is the daughter of a union miner. But if one is going to live with any degree of honesty with oneself, one has to deal with problems like this. And the problem now, and for several years, has been that the UMWA cares not a tinker's damn about the mountain communities from which its long heritage of struggle arises. Because you cannot care about a community that you are in the business of destroying. We talked a few weeks ago about a New York Times article on a little West Virginia dot on the map called Lindytown. Lindytown is a ghost town now. Lindytown has everything but tumbleweeds. The churches are abandoned. The homes are gone or going, bought out and marked for destruction by a coal company. It was a little union town once. Now, it's gone. It's gone. It's over. And the list of towns destroyed, as Lindytown has been, reads like a list of the dead. And some of those towns have been killed by the United Mine Workers of America. I'm not going to blush from there is no more profoundly vigorous voice for organized labor in this country than what I am. But I am not going to blink. I am not going to blush. And I am not going to hide from reality. So, you need to just remember, when you start seeing lots and lots and lots of publicity about this march, if anyone asks you a question, you make it clear to them that this march doesn't have a damned thing to do with the union or the romantic history of gunfire, privation, and starvation and attack that took place 90 years ago. It doesn't have a damned thing to do with it. It has to do with the fact that mountaintop removal and surface mining must end. Okay? Okay. And you got to understand, the United Mine Workers of America will never, ever denounce mountaintop removal because they have members working on mountaintop removal sites. Cecil Roberts, the president of the United Mine Workers of America, has been part of the assault on people of good conscience and goodwill struggling to end mountaintop removal. Tree huggers. He has been part of the assault on the Environmental Protection Agency for doing little more than its job. And barely that. He has gone hand in hand with the coal bosses to insist that mountaintop removal persist, and not only persist, that it expand. I don't know if you noticed or not, but the purchase of Massey Energy by Alpha Natural Resources has gone through. Look for the UMWA to put on an organizing push. Alpha Natural Resources is not going to stop doing mountaintop removal until they are legally compelled to do so. Guess what? Nothing would make Cecil Roberts happier than to be able to organize every mountaintop removal site that Massey and now Alpha Natural Resources controls. Nothing would make him happier. And he would gladly set off the first union charge on a Massey mountaintop removal site. The first blast. I'm not making this up. These are facts. So I felt like you needed to know that. So when we are in D.C., we will be calling for an absolute abolition to mountaintop removal for the sake of all Appalachian people, even the people working on the sites who are poisoning their own children. And you can tune in 10:30 Eastern Daylight Time on the Horns Ustream channel. Okay? Okay. So it's about 26 minutes past the hour. A brief mention. We are into June. It's the second day of June. We finished May behind the first, but it was the first time this year. We had 4 months of solid fundraising. We finished May in the hole. And so we begin June, but it wasn't a deep hole. We've certainly been in deeper ones. The hole we finished in was about $200 deep. So we've got a chance to make that up in June, barring the fact that I'm not going to be behind the microphone nearly enough to flog away and implore membership in the Thrifty 250. So while I am here, we do need the PayPal button hit, if you can. Remember, ultimately, we're trying to build things up to where one person, $10, to the tune of 250 people doing $10, and you know, it all works out. So we are we need tonight, let's just make it easy. 26 members of the Thrifty 250, 26, and that will take up, that'll finish May, and get us well on the road to June. Okay. Now, back to those little snapshots. You know, in many ways, I remember my youth better than I remember things 10 or 15 years ago. I think that's the curse of growing up, or as Jimmy Buffett says, growing older but not up. But guys, because back then the girls weren't exactly being urged to do this. Guys, you remember that little ring in your that little round shape on the back of your wallet? For some of us, it was there forever because the thing making the shape never left the wallet. It was, of course, a condom. But, you know, like a Boy Scout, you got to be prepared. You never know when lightning might strike and you might actually, you know. In my case, and a lot of others, nobody really had the courage to march proudly into a drugstore and ask, because they were always behind the counter, ask for I'll take the industrial-sized box of Trojans, please. No. No, slowly through the juvenile grapevine, you found out that, that truck stop out there at the intersection of 72 and 43 across the river, they got a machine in the men's room where if you put in 50 cents, you can get right. And that's where you got the thing that made the ring. It is, I suppose, a different world in which we live now. Because for some people, I guess you could argue, in this day and age, apparently, at least in New York City, having that ring in your that ring shape on the back of your wallet would be prima facie proof that you were breaking the law. No, really. a story from Alternet by Laura Rena Murray. She writes, at Lafayette Avenue and Barreto Street, a young man slowly navigated a maroon van past empty warehouses in search of street sex workers. The woman seated next to him remained silent, staring out the passenger side window. When he saw a familiar woman walking alone, he pulled over and decided to wait as she solicited a black Nissan. Less than 2 months after getting, or 2 minutes after getting in the car, she exited and approached the van to get condoms and food. She nervously told the woman in the passenger seat of the van that she turned the Nissan down after realizing it was an undercover cop. When the van circled the block 5 minutes later, the same woman was caught between two gray and black vans. Her wrists were cuffed, and a stained canvas bag lay at her feet. Its contents, the newly acquired condoms, and the needed food, were spilled out onto the street. The van, the people in the van distributing the condoms and the food, work for an organization called Citywide. It's a harm reduction organization in the South Bronx. Citywide gives away free condoms, health supplies, to intravenous drug users and sex workers. Food for people who need it. You know, there's a public policy, public health, good reason for giving away condoms. Because it's not like there's not enough HIV, not enough syphilis, not enough gonorrhea, not enough herpes, not enough human papillomavirus. It's not like there's not enough of all of that in New York City as it is. And, of course, these sex workers are among the most poor, often fragile, and exploited human beings in the city. But never let it be said that the police aren't out there doing their job. And now, what has developed when a woman, for instance, gets arrested, as in the scenario I just read to you, the police bag and tag the condoms as proof of her criminal intent to engage in prostitution. Dern! I would have thought that possession of condoms was proof of your intent not to create pregnancy and not to spread disease. But no, the police in New York say that a woman carrying condoms, well, that just proves she means to sell her body. It's another one of those, I guess, John Mellencamp ain't that America moments. Instead of trying to defeat the scourge that is sexually transmitted disease, we intimidate sex workers into not using them. Because, oh gosh, Joe Friday voice. Any condom you possess can and will be used against you in a court of law. That's one of the snapshots. That's one of the snapshots. if you can do that, the walk a mile in her shoes sort of thing, imagine what a sort of Damocles that is over your head. We're talking about the South Bronx. We're not talking about the high-end so-called call girls. We're talking about hookers on the street. Women in their late 40s. Doing what they can just to stay alive. Citywide has what I think all of us would agree is a noble mission. Stem the flowing tide of disease and provide just a little bit of decency in lives that are harder than most anything you and I could imagine. So, what do the police do? They tail the citywide van. And when a woman comes up to get the hygiene kit, to get the condoms, to maybe get a bite to eat, they then trail her, solicit her, and arrest her. And as I said, they bag and tag the condoms as proof, as evidence to be used against her, to convict her. Frankly, to convict her of her decision as to how to use her body. In the story I'm looking at here from Alternet, four separate arrests occurred within sight of the van. Two took place immediately after sex workers accessed services from Citywide. Who do you think the genius was that came up with that? Using the attempt to slow the spread of disease as evidence against sex workers. I mean, this isn't one of those nobody. You know, there are, for instance, to provide some semblance of balance here, there are laws in virtually every state about that criminalize. Sometimes it's a misdemeanor, sometimes it's a felony. That criminalize the possession of burglars' tools, lock picks. You know, when you call a locksmith, he has a very specialized, or she, skill set that allows him or her to get into a locked door. And they have lock-picking tools. And a good one? There's not a lock been made. Can't be opened. But for you and me to carry a ring of picks, The law has made a determination that probably is intent that you and I are up to no good. Because really we don't need to be able to pick just any lock, we need to have a spare house key and a spare car key, and then after that we're pretty well done. Maybe a spare post office box key. And so there is a reasonable public policy determination that we don't want everybody and their cousin running around with burglars' tools. But everyone in New York City who is in a non-monogamous relationship has a damned fine reason for being in possession of condoms. Even people in monogamous relationships who perhaps don't want to have a pregnancy have a damned fine reason for carrying condoms. It reminds me of something that I've often said, and that is that the very basic case that began to expand reproductive freedom in this country is called Griswold versus Connecticut. And it was a question over, it was a Supreme Court case, and it was a question over birth control and whether it was legal. And the Supreme Court ruled that it is. Well, whether it be a pill, a diaphragm, or a condom, these are all things that, among other things, the right wing hates. They profess to hate abortions. But you also recall the stories of pharmacists who won't fill birth control prescriptions or prescriptions for the morning after pill because the bizarre sickos of the religion industry right wing say that that causes a silent abortion. And those are all, of course, very much authoritarian organizations, and there is no organization more authoritarian than a police department. So that's one of those little snapshots of America. Just another moment of poor and fragile people being held, ground under the thumb of a merciless state. So let's run down the eastern seaboard now. Let's run down the eastern seaboard to Orlando, Florida. And another effort to do the real world, real time work that Palestinian day laborer the right wing so professes to revere said for people to do. You know, clothe the naked, house the homeless, feed the hungry, heal the sick, visit the imprisoned. In Orlando, Florida, there is an organization called Food Not Bombs. Certainly, seems a straightforward statement of purpose. Food Not Bombs. You know, butter, not guns. In Orlando, the city has an ordinance. Wait for this. Because this is just stunning. The next time you hear some right-winger talking about how we live in the greatest, most Christian nation in America, you tell them about this story. In Orlando, they have a city ordinance that says it is illegal to feed the homeless. Yeah, just let that one rattle around a minute. In Orlando, Florida, it is illegal to feed the homeless. I guess it's not illegal in Orlando, Florida to watch them starve to death. So, on Wednesday, Jessica Cross, age 24, Benjamin Markison, age 49, and Jonathan Keith McHenry, age 54, all members of Food Orlando Food Not Bombs, were arrested for violating a city ordinance that bans group feedings in public parks. That bans group feedings in public parks. Now, because it's America, I'm pretty willing to bet that the missions and the shelters have all the work they can do. And so, one wonders where one will go to feed the homeless. Well, by God, I think they ought to go to the church. That's the church's jobs. What if the homeless aren't comfortable going to a church and being made to listen to some blather about Jeebus before they're given a bowl of soup and a crust of bread? Douglas Coleman is a spokesman for Orlando Food Not Bombs. He said, the police basically carted them off to jail for feeding hungry people. For them to regulate a time and a place for free speech and to share food, that is unacceptable. Orlando Food Not Bombs is not a wealthy organization. They've been able to provide about 2 meals a week for the last 5 years. And for some, those may be the only 2 meals, the only 2 regular meals they get. Everything else is catch as catch can. But Food Not Bombs has laid out a breakfast on Mondays and supper on Wednesdays. Deciding the question on First Amendment grounds, the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta ruled that it is not a violation of the Constitution for cities to regulate how often large groups of people can be fed in a park. And so the way it works out is that under the statute, groups have to obtain a permit to do so, and each group may only have two permits per year for each park that exists within a 2-mile radius of City Hall. Oh, so that's what it is. Feed the homeless, just don't feed them in city parks where the upstanding, godly, right-wing, repig-licking bastards have to look at them. Jessica Cross, Benjamin Markison, and Jonathan Keith McHenry are all facing $500 fines, 60 days each in jail, or both. How about that? You go to the Clink in Orlando. What are you in for? Feeding hungry people. How about you? See, there won't be a revolution in America or anything. Because we won't do revolution over things that maybe revolution is worth doing over, like the right of the people to feed other people. We won't do that. No, not at all. Cross and Markison were released on $250 bail each. Keith McHenry is staying in jail to let the legal process take its course. That takes courage that most of the city leaders will never even dream of having. Snapshots. Little snapshots of a dying, crumbling nation. Just little pictures. Not a lot. Just a little. A little bit here and a little bit there. Back north we go. Up the eastern seaboard to Maine. Yes, Maine. I know Malloy talked about this. We've talked about this. Guess what? It was shortly after the show last night that our chat room buddy Jug of Punch shot me a note and said, well, the bastards have done it. Writing for Daily Coast, an article by Joan McCarter. Joan says, 1850, here we come. Governor Paul LePage has signed into law a bill to ease Maine's, because that's what it needed, easing. Because it was so oppressive, the chains of the law were chafing the wrists of business. See how dodgy journalism works. Governor Paul LePage has signed into law a bill to ease Maine's child labor restrictions so teenagers can work longer hours. Supporters say the new law helps businesses looking for youthful help and also helps teenagers who need the money. As Joan McCarter notes, Maine has nearly 8% unemployment. That means that those jobs could easily be filled without expanding the work hours of children! We take you now to the ghost of President Calvin Coolidge. President Coolidge, the business of America is business. Which is a kind of a cute, catchy 1920s way of saying that a human being is less valuable than a bank mule. Well, look for this legislation to spread like a nasty little disease. No let up, is there? Sadly, I fear not. So that takes us to the close of the first hour of the program. We'll take a little break and come back with your calls, if you want. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. We got our first two slots in the Thrifty 250 filled this evening. We're down to only 24 needed. Thank you. Thank you kindly. So, the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen is on its way. And after that, hopefully, your calls, if you're so inclined. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, June 2nd, 2011.
John headed the company for almost 20 years, during which time he helped Edison become a leader in solar and wind power and innovative approaches to proving the profitability of clean energy.
Obama nominates a radical environmentalist for Commerce Secretary. FDA sued over antibiotic-resistant superbugs. No wildlands for you. Killer cucumbers. Plus, the Arctic is melting, yet the media is obsessed with Wiener.
You heard her right. All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Well, you know, that's how democracy works in West Virginia, is that you have a few large coal companies who have subverted democracy at every level. They've corrupted the judges. They've corrupted the public officials. As we showed, two-thirds of the people in West Virginia oppose mountaintop mining. But there's not a single politician in the state who opposes it because they've been purchased by the coal industry.
You say that like it's a bad thing, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This snarky comment brought to you by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, subverting democracy ever since you have stopped paying attention. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, we saw yet another killer tornado yesterday as this remarkable wave continues, this time in Massachusetts, not exactly Tornado Alley.
No, it's not. It's quite unusual in what is already shaping up to be a record year for tornado activity in the U.S. The National Weather Service says that tornadoes in Massachusetts are not unique, but they are very rare. Killer cucumbers are not the cause of a deadly outbreak of E. coli food poisoning in Germany. European Union food safety officials still do not know the source of a deadly outbreak of that contamination that's killed at least 16 people and seriously sickened over 1,000. Most of them in northern Germany. Officials have been stunned, they say, at the severity of the outbreak, and they now say that the rare and unusually virulent strain of E. coli bacteria is not the same strain found on cucumbers from Spain and is therefore not the source. The uncertainty is causing European trading partners and Russia to ban the import of certain vegetables from Germany and Spain, causing quite a bit of economic loss for farmers in that area.
I understand Spanish cucumber farmers are none too happy about it.
Here in the U.S., several environmental and public health groups are suing the Food and Drug Administration in an attempt to force the government to stop farmers from routinely adding antibiotics to livestock feed. The industrial farming technique of giving antibiotics to healthy animals to prevent illness has been implicated in the alarming rise of antibiotic-resistant superbugs, including Salmonella and E. coli, the same bacteria in the deadly outbreak in Germany. An estimated 80% of the U.S. antibiotic supply goes to healthy farm animals to keep them from getting sick in crowded factory farm conditions and to help the animals grow faster.
Antibiotics. Delicious.
The administration is also under fire this week for abandoning an ambitious new proposal to protect more of the nation's wilderness. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar announced the withdrawal of the plan this week after strong opposition from Western governors and a move by the Republican majority in the House to completely defund the program. Environmental groups slammed the retreat as caving in to drilling and development interests.
Republican Teddy Roosevelt, champion of public lands, would be proud.
But environmental groups and business lobbyists praised President Obama's new choice for Commerce Secretary.
I am pleased to announce that I will nominate John Bryson to be our nation's next Commerce Secretary.
The president highlighted Bryson's unusual career path from co-founding the Natural Resources Defense Council to 20 years as president of one of the nation's largest electric utilities, experience that President Obama said would be crucial to advancing U.S. clean energy markets.
Of course, in the years ahead, a key to achieving our export goal will be promoting clean energy in America. That's how we'll reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and that's how we'll encourage new businesses and jobs to take root on our shores. John headed the company for almost 20 years, during which time he helped Edison become a leader in solar and wind power and innovative approaches to proving the profitability of clean energy.
Even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce praised the move, but congressional Republicans, including prominent climate change denier Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, has already vowed to block the nomination, calling Bryson, quote, a radical environmentalist. Finally, the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center put out a new study this week showing that the Arctic permafrost melt is accelerating and that the Arctic will cross the tipping point within the next 20 years, yet the media is obsessed with Wiener. Congressman Anthony Weiner.
Speaking of which, you can follow us on Twitter at Green News Report. You may or may not get a photo of Desi or I in gray underwear. For more on the stories we covered today and those that we did not in Green News Extra, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report over your public airwaves. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Nothing really matters. Nothing really matters to me.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Total Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Oh. Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Total Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got your bad, bad body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Alrighty, we're making progress. We're down to needing to fill only 22 slots in the Thrifty 250. Down from 26. We can do this, I bet. Email rolling in from William out in California. They had and may still have the same law about not feeding the homeless here in California. It was the same thing. You needed a permit. I have to ask, what sort of country is this when feeding people is a crime rather than a question of morality? This is so sick that these laws are even allowed to be written and, worse, carried out. Yet it's quite okay to poison the environment on every level one can imagine, and it's quite all right to bomb people, and it's quite okay to remain ignorant, hidden behind some belief system which actually promotes morality in the writings, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, that's a central tenet of virtually every major religion on the planet. William closes saying shame is not a strong enough word. But you see, what you got to take into account is that repiglickens, these vile, filthy right-wingers, these disgusting the worshippers at the altar of unholy profit, they don't look at things the way normal people do. They look at things through a sort of sickened prism, not through a glass darkly, but through a glass sickly. Because where you and I, being normal people and people of decent conscience, we would tend to look at the issue of homeless people, and being liberals, being progressive, whatever we prefer to call ourselves, we look at the situation and say, how can we alleviate the problem?
How can we end the problem? And many of us would come up with statements like, perhaps we need greater funding for feeding hungry people. Perhaps we need better and broader and more public housing in this country. Perhaps we need to impose taxation sufficient to pay for those things. Whereas the broken brains of the right wing merely look at homeless people and say, you know what? If we don't have to look at them, they don't matter. The key to the homeless problem is to stop having to look at homelessness. So while we got a city park over there that belongs in the public commons and is properly public property, we're going to make us some laws where we won't have to look at no homeless people in them getting food when they could just as easily go somewhere and die. Was it Alan Grayson? Yes, it was Alan Grayson who said, the Republican health care plan is to die and die quickly. Well, it has, that mindset that brought us die quickly has further applications. Starve quickly. Die of exposure quickly. But for the love of right-wing God, please do it out of sight of any upstanding, God-fearing Republicans. You see, that's how the Republican mind is. They don't see in a homeless person a fellow human being. They don't see in a homeless person someone who was once a beloved infant daughter or son for whom the world went sideways and the free market just didn't seem to work. They don't see that. And they feel no sense of obligation to them. They see merely something that they wish not to see. Out of sight, out of mind is an old and trite saying. But for the Republican Party and for conservatives and people with family values who adhere to a culture of life, out of sight, out of mind is a fully functioning, active philosophy of life. Because, you know, it says right there in their conservative Bible, and Jesus said unto them, get all these dirty people out away from me. What do you think I want to say? God, get me a clothespin. These people stink. Can't you get me over to the palace? Me, damn. This is pretty awful. And lo, the disciples did put Jesus aboard the back of a white donkey and take him into the better quarters of the town, where he did sit and sup and have a high old time once he couldn't see those awful, icky, poor people anymore. Amen and amen and amen. Worlds without end. Amen. Right? So what do you say we go to the phones? You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I remember, you know, in the last couple of elections, the way to solve the homeless people crisis, the housing crisis, is simply to make people buy houses.
There you go.
And the way to solve the health care problem is just force people to buy medical insurance. Remember that? Problem solved.
Look, we made it all better.
It doesn't matter if you can pay for it or not. Problem solved.
Yeah, and if you can't, somebody will make a dime off of it. Look, capitalism works.
Well, you can always just throw that person out of their house later, and then, I don't know, you'll figure something out, but it looks good on paper.
And everybody knows that the paper is where it's at, Reverbo.
It is where it's at. Now, last night, you came up with something I really liked, and it was getting a degree. I'm adding to this, of course. You can major in. What am I trying to say? You can get two majors. You can get a major in paranoia by taking some classes at the School of Suspicion.
Yes. Juanita.
Talking about this. But Juanita, this was just perfect because, I mean, how can anybody who's paying attention in the last 50 years, you know, not have a nice, get that in the mail, that degree of, sheepskin with that says you have completed, the appropriate amount of classes for a minor in suspicion from a major university of your choice. Of course you can. I was listening to, I wanted to call you a couple weeks ago and go over this thing. I keep listening to NPR because, well, NPR is somewhat of a last bastion of truth. They
try.
NPR. Yeah, they try. They're not the same as they were, but they try. So anyway, somebody, Terry Gross, I don't know who, they had this guy on who had just finished writing a book, a conspiracy guy. He's written the official story. He's written a book on conspiracies and like who, what kind of a person falls for conspiracies and stereotyping, typecasting, the type of person who kind of tends to, in his words, won't accept the world as it is. So right away, I didn't like this guy. Okay, I smelled a rat right away, and this is what they do with, you know, the way they rewrote the Ronald Reagan legacy.
Yeah, it's kind of like that language about easing labor restrictions on business.
Yeah, you're just, right away, everybody can just tell where you're coming from here. You have this condescending attitude. You're ridiculing these people. You're marginalizing them.
Well, what you don't understand, Reverbo, is the world is not fair. The world's a hard place where you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
You mean that kind of stuff?
Right.
And
yeah.
Sitting around and wishing it was different won't do you any good.
That's right. You just can't accept things the way they are. And then, of course, I remember you had some people calling in about, I don't know if it was Gary or somebody, we're talking about the electric car, the original EV1, and how that...
Yeah, I think that was Andy.
Yeah, and how, I mean, I can need we bring up, I mean, Nikola Tesla couldn't even carry Thomas Edison's lunch pail, and you saw what they ended up doing to him, and what Edison and GE, or was it Westinghouse, ended up doing to him. I mean, here was a guy who basically, I mean, they backed the wrong horse. They backed direct current. Tesla came up with AC, not to mention an idea for a free energy grid. And, I mean, they just ruined him.
Free?
So, you know,
that's a dirty word.
Yeah, and so the more this guy was talking about, well, conspiracy folks are mostly, the liberal, a middle-aged white liberal guy in his 50s who just really is having trouble, you know, with the way the world really, really turns around. Yeah, he paid lip service a little to the idea, well, both sides have their favorite conspiracies, right? On the other side, you've got, like, there's the socialist conspiracy, whereas, you know, on the progressive side, you might have the global warming conspiracy, or I may be getting these confused, but you know what I mean.
Well, and if they're on our side, they have to. They're radical.
Well, yeah, and again, there's this throwing in the false equivalency because I don't remember too many conspiracies that you and I came up with that weren't pretty much grounded in the truth. We don't have to go all the way back to the Gulf of Tonkin and the Church Committee to. We don't have to dredge all this shit up. And I don't know too many of the other crazy ones that were, well, anything more than just flat crazy. So I don't want to hear about how everybody has their conspiracies and we're all crazy. Sorry. I know a little more about my history than that. I know I've heard of Iran-Contra, okay? I know what the CIA did in South America and in Southeast Asia. You know, this kind of stuff just blows my mind. Anyway. So this guy, it was a call-in show, and someone called in with this great question about, well, what about election fraud? Okay, what about the election of 2004? What about this crap that was going on in Ohio? What about these these servers that were counting votes in Tennessee, and what about all this kind of stuff? And here you go. His answer? Well, you know, this kind of stuff, it just can't really happen in America. It hardly ever does, because we're so transparent here, Bob.
See right through us. To expand the metaphor, Reverbo, we're not just transparent because we're see-through, we're transparent because we are growing thinner and thinner and thinner, if you know what I mean. There's no fabric left.
Well, and another way of looking at that is that they don't even try to hide it from you anymore. It's the thing about it that pissed me off is there's this assumption of transparency. It's like we keep trotting out this legend of America that there's just no way you could pull the wool over anybody's eyes. Well, let me tell you, they're not trying to anymore. Look at people.
No, they're out in the open. It's good. When you take 100 years of labor law regarding children, Reverbo, and you just march out in the public square and say, you know, these little bastards are sitting around too much playing on them damn Game Boy boxes. We got to get them working. When your workforce is 8% unemployed, no, screw transparency. It's all out in the open. They're thumping their chests and they're proud of it.
Well, and the only place, the only group that resonates with is, well, you know, our lovable wealth chump. Well, the only people that will even vote for, can you imagine the Republicans, what they're doing now? They you know, we love to talk about the Republicans and their eliminationist rhetoric, but in fact they really do have a death wish because they cannot stand prosperity. Here they are, and they came up with this fantastic plan, according to them, of, tell you what, here's what we'll do. And they just all can't wait to just lay this out for the American people. As part of our plan to basically repeal every piece of social legislation, every piece of legislation for middle and working class people since the 1930s. Let's just start with Medicare. We'll just completely gut that. We'll turn it into a for-profit enterprise, and we'll give people a couple of little vouchers, and you better hope you don't have anything more than strep throat, my friend, or we're going to have to build...
No, hell, you won't be able to afford the meds for the strep throat. You better hope you're a hypochondriac when you go to the doc.
There will be so many private prisons for people declaring bankruptcy. There'll be one on every block. Sorry. You know, if you can't afford, I guess you're just going to have to. You better not get sick. And I'm sitting here, and then they go, and then when of course it just falls flat on its face. I mean, where else is it going to go? Nobody wants this. Then what do they look at each other just in disbelief and go, "Damn! I thought this would be huge. I thought everybody'd love this idea."
And, you know, when I first read the story, I mean, it just gets sicker and weirder and twisteder and yuck. When I first read the story that they were talking about making Groupons available to senior citizens, I thought, well, you know, it was another one of those, wait a minute, where's the onion in this? Oh, my God, they're serious. Really? Did Paul Ryan really say... that, and of course we could provide Groupons to senior citizens to help them save on a wide variety of goods and services?
Just like queue up at the Walmart, Medical Center. I mean, but the great thing is just imagine these people. This is the thing that kills me. How can they have possibly thought that the American people will just embrace this plan? God, it's like, I can't wait for this. How soon can we start? And, of course, now their numbers are absolutely tanking. The money, the smart money, obviously is on Obama for another 4 years. I hope he gets something done, but that's not even...
I got one to throw out at you, Reverbo.
All right.
No president in modern memory has been reelected since FDR with an unemployment rate in excess of 7.2%.
I don't like it.
And with that in mind, there are certain numbers that are rolling around and more coming tomorrow that are leading, I guess, the people who understand those numbers to say, oh, look, we're double dipping.
Well, don't even read Krugman these days. He's pretty much predicting now.
Well, no, but then again, there's a beautiful sort of irony to this. The waveform that is being formed by this double dip is in the shape of the letter W.
Really?
Went down, tottered back up a little bit, going back down again, and somewhere out there it'll totter back up and it'll look like a W.
It'll look just like a W.
But again, you said don't read Krugman. Well, sadly I do. And the thing is,
you can't, because he's ready for, you know.
Oh, he's out on the ledge.
Oh yeah.
When it's not his fault. You know, when you're the guy standing on the bow of the Titanic, Reverbo, and you're screaming, iceberg! Iceberg! To the top of your lungs, and the captain says, did I hear someone say, we need ice? It's not your fault. Because Krugman has been screaming about the double dip to anybody who will listen. And that is the essential problem of our increasingly failed experiment in self-rule, is that nobody wants to. Nobody wants to listen. Nobody wants to hear that. Turn up the band. There's a lovely, you know, there's a lovely the turkey trot going on right now.
Oh, you're talking, oh, yeah, just bring in, throw Chris Hedges into that group. Throw James Consular into that group. I mean, these are people who are just saying, you folks have no freaking idea.
And you put, and you get your little sheet of paper and you write down that very famous old phrase, a prophet is never welcome in his own land. And you put Consular, and you put Robert Reich, and you put Krugman, and you put Hedges, all and us, I guess.
Well, you got to put us in there.
All Joe Bagent. You put them all on that list. And the thing is, if we're going to treat it like a ledger, who's on the other side of the list that said, oh, this will all work out just dandy if we make the biggest part of the biggest single part of the stimulus package tax cuts, Reverbo. Tax cuts. Chimney.
I mean, it just goes back to who, if they told you the truth and they weren't just, featuring the Joseph Goebbels school of propaganda, if they actually told you what they wanted to do, which I guess we figured out now, that they are telling you. They're not hiding behind anything. It is in fact as transparent as it's ever been, which I guess is so weird and twisted, people can't even process that. But you've got a bunch of people, well, like George Will, you've got people who are simply unable to acknowledge, refuse to acknowledge that it is their side, that it's the right wing that has engineered all of this. They just will not acknowledge it. And so the only people that will vote for them are the well-heeled, right? The ones who are going to reap the profits of this horrible class, the ultimate result of this class warfare, and of course the well-jumped. Otherwise, no one would vote for them. No woman, no minority, no one in the working class, no one in the middle class. I mean, how many registered voters are there in the United States? When you break them all out like that, the Republicans shouldn't get any votes. I just don't like this guy on with the conspiracy show. He was talking about, I mean, this whole thing about the authoritarian profile. It just goes back to what we talk about all the time. Don't ask questions. Just believe the official story, you know, this condescending attitude. And what the problem is, of course, it is eventually impossible to track down the truth about any. Impossible.
Yeah. Well, and part of that is because we insist on using that that troublesome word, that problem child of the language, truth. Because what we've got to, I think what we really have to traffic in now, Reverbo, is facts. Facts. And 8.8 whatever unemployment and perhaps rising again, that's a fact. There's no getting away from it.
You know, it was also a fact that the 2010 elections where the conservatives took back the House, I believe they ran on where all these jobs they promised them. I mean, we are dealing with a unbelievably fickle electorate.
And well, that's why I said the other night that the American electorate, and I think I was actually stealing from Chris Hedges, the American electorate is no longer capable in large part. Now, this is not a blanket statement because obviously it doesn't apply to Malloy's Truth Seekers. It doesn't apply to the Horn. There's a chunk of people it doesn't apply to. But in the main, the American electorate is no longer able to engage in significant political thought or analysis. The only thing they've got left is throw the bums out. And what that leads to, I think I'm using the right word here, Reverbo, what that leads to is a state of absolute, unending political entropy in which the fire brigade has been replaced by a string quartet who fiddles while the nation burns.
You could have used the word inertia.
Yeah, inertia.
I mean, nothing will change. Well, and if nothing changes, all the bad stuff keeps going.
Well, then again, some things have changed. Remember, it is now a fact that Citizens United money, corporate donations, can go directly to candidates. That changed.
Yeah, that changed.
No, you were talking. You said a couple of minutes ago that if you break it down that way, there's no way there should be a single Republican vote in the United States. And it immediately reminded me of something that David in Tennessee said to me a couple of nights ago. In regard to the truly stunning behavior, even for him, of Eric Brittany Cantor. Talking about how, well, we're not going to help Joplin, Missouri unless you cut something else, preferably Medicare. You know, all that. And David in Tennessee said, you know, Bob, someplace in Joplin, Missouri, Marvelline's husband, Eustace, is saying to her, you know, honey, that there Cantor guy from Virginia hates us the way they're telling us the Democrats hates America. How about that?
I'm sure waiting for that day. Well,
the thing is, I don't think we can wait. Reverbo, I don't think that it can happen in some sort of mass enlightenment. It might, you know, Eustace and Marvelline, they're going to figure it out because they're living in a tent and it's still raining. But their cousins, Emery and Eileen, who didn't get the house blown away, it hasn't dawned on them. You know, Jim just wrote in and said, facts have become revisionist factoids. That word came into some sort of parlance in the 90s, I guess it was, a factoid. Something that was factual, but not quite a fact. It was like as if they had done some sort of atomic split of what it was to be a fact and just taken out some little chunk of it. Facts have become revisionist factoids. And so as long as they're just little minuscule pieces, they have no independent reality of their own unless they're rejoined to the whole fact. And so it is that while Eustace and Marvelline may be beginning to get it out there in the rain, Emery and Eileen, not so much.
I always thought even the dimmest neck could perceive when they were getting bamboozled. At some point, I mean, the 2010 election, those people bamboozled you. Your life is no better now because because the House of Representatives is full of these D-bags. You were bamboozled. It's just, I like saying that word because it's just a funny word. But, I mean, what... here's something. I'll sort of leave you with this here. I never really got a chance to. I'm sure you guys talked about the report on the Upper Big Branch mine plenty, and that might have been about the time that my computer was in the shop. But you do remember that they were doing autopsies on the dead miners, and geez, about 23 out of 29 of them had evidence of black lung disease in their lungs.
Sure.
And they were underground less than 10 years, a whole bunch of them. And this stuff doesn't even...
Right, because if you're underground for a Massey, for instance, or just about any non-union operator, for all the problems I have with the UMWA, this isn't one of them. In almost any non-union hole, wearing one's West... Oh, dear, I almost turned into Madeline Kahn. Wearing one's respirator, you know how it almost, wearing one's respirator, it's either that or Barbara Walters, wearing one's respirator in that macho culture was deemed to be sissy, okay? That's why these things, these regulations have to actually have the force and effect of law. And it's worth remembering that every year, now, not 50 years ago, every year, now, Reverbo, 1,000 coal workers die of black lung. In 2011, 1,000 will die. That's roughly three a day. Today, 3 coal workers died from black lung in the 21st century.
It's unconscionable. The report, you know, just totally roiled everybody who needed it. I was pleased to see that they just roasted Massey. But
Reverbo, that was all a set piece. That was all a dumb show for the groundlings, because Alpha has now been absorbed Massey, yeah, and business will go on.
And no one is in jail yet for any of this, and it was clearly. But to connect the dots back to the beginning, conspiracies and stereotypes, and, well, you know, you all just can't accept the world the way it is. Well, the conclusion, of course, in that report was that there were inadequate regulations. And I always thought it was kind of odd that the bigger conclusion wasn't that when you have an anti-regulatory attitude, you can buy off the regulators. That's the bigger point for me.
And I think it's the absolute truth.
It's easy to say the regulations weren't adequate. Well, not if I'm buying... It doesn't matter how adequate they are. If I'm slipping judges million-dollar checks, and that's okay.
Well, there's that, and that whole... But that whole response to regulation is one whose genesis can be found in the dark and dirty, creepy, filthy corners of the National Republican Rifle Association, because that has long been their argument. You know, every time some toddler gets blown away at school, and we say, you know what, maybe we might want to think about limiting people's ability to get handguns quite so easily, so they can't blow away toddlers in school. From time immemorial, the National Republican Rifle Association has then screamed at the top of its considerable lungs, "We don't need no more regulations. What we need to do is enforce the ones we done got." Which is a way of saying, please, can we just stop talking about this and turn away? And look, a shiny thing.
In a weird way. Well, it's just you know, when you have people in power who basically strip all the oomph, all the money, just there are, you know, regulation is at the very bottom of the administrative, you know, priorities. What did, you are setting the table for tragedy here.
But it's only a tragedy for the people who are living it, Reverbo. It's a capitalist, free market wonderland for the people who are profiting by it. My God, think about those major medical Groupons we were talking about a minute ago. Marvelline, that hip replacement, y'all need to have to wait a few months, honey. This quarter's Groupon for major stuff is for knee replacements. Sorry, darling.
And I guess if I, you know, if a bunch of my friends die from drinking that, from drinking Billy's bottled water, well, the way we'll get back at Billy in the free market is just to quit buying his water and put him out of business.
Right, because we're dead.
Right. That's called the invisible hand of the free market. Works like a dream.
That's some catch, that catch 22.
These people want to go back, I guess, even farther than 200 or 300 years. I don't know where I want to go. I'll leave you with this. I'm sure this, everyone noted this, but it's worth checking out again. That Serbian war criminal they just caught, his name's Ratko. I'll spell that for you. R-A-T-K-O. His first name was Ratko.
Wow, beautiful.
You can't make that stuff up.
No, you most assure Ratko.
Yeah, that's his name.
Sounds like a new corporation here in America.
It does.
Just call Ratko.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be soon. Well, you make it personal.
Absolutely. And what do you think of the bumper sticker idea, Reverbo? Well chumped? ? Goya.
Goya. Yeah, that's gonna. Yeah, you might as well throw that in too.
Get off your ass. I just like it.
All right, well, we'll work on it. Anyway, it sounds like you have a very interesting month of June coming up.
It's going to be right busy.
And maybe we can catch some of this on the Internet and off and on. So
and I'll be behind the microphone as often as I possibly can. I mean, you know, here, but... The history seminar is, I mean, this is master's degree level teaching.
Oh, he's so good. Are you going to let us know if you're going to happen to be on the air just with a horn show off and on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm going to publish the schedule. I've just got to have enough presence of mind to do what I promised I would do and then spaced on, and that is send the actual schedule to News Ninja Susan.
Okay. We've had plenty of wild facts about how few people in the United States own how much of the wealth. But I heard on another show someone has some algorithm, or some people have expanded this out even more. Get this. Evidently, 1% of people in the world, 1% of human beings, own 39% of all the wealth on the planet.
Yeah, I think I made mention of that last night. What a stunning,
okay.
What a stunning number that is. I mean, I love to simplify things. I like to reduce things to apples and oranges. You know what I mean? So imagine you've got 100 people. One person steps out. Imagine you've got 100 apples and 100 oranges. That one person steps out of the line and you give them 39 apples and 39 oranges and tell the other 99 to split, you know, the other 61 apples and 61 oranges, and good luck with all that.
Then you might as well just tell them to pound sand or duck eggs. I mean, it's just, it's amazing.
Well, no, because that one out of 100 is going to get 39 of the eggs, too, and 39% of the sand.
Damn. So any time you come up, you produce anything, almost 40% of it's going to go to them, no matter what it is.
Yeah. It's going to go to the Sultan of Brunei. It's going to go to the Royal House of Ibn Saud. It's going to go to Steve Jobs. It's going to go to Bill Gates. It's going to go to Dick Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go to the smartest guys in the world up at Goldman Sachs. It's going to go to Shashi and Ravi Ruia of Mumbai, India, who have decided that my family doesn't have the right to live in peace, that they need to disassemble my mountain and send it on a boat to Mumbai. Yeah, I mean, think about that, Reverbo.
Oh, yeah.
Think about that.
It almost 1%
of the world is entitled to actually remove 39% of the Appalachian Mountains and take it home with them. Remember the MASH episode where the Klinger was mailing home a Jeep one piece at a time?
Yes, I do.
This is that. Only it ain't funny.
It ain't funny, and it, because it almost makes you makes you feel like you're getting backed up, your whole body's getting backed up, and do you have any idea, for example, how many bowls of your cereal it would take to equal the fiber content of just one bowl of Colon Blow?
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. You guess. What do you think? Two, maybe three.
Eight, maybe 12.
Keep trying.
39?
Yes, again.
168.
Nope. Not even close. It would take over 30,000 bowls of your Oat Brand cereal to equal the fiber content of Colon Blow.
There you go. And you know what? And you know what? The that 1% of the world, they want everybody's 30,000 bowls.
I'll bet they do. Oh, my.
No, and by the way, well, okay, from the irony department, this in from Jim real quick. The only president with 7.2 unemployment, or greater than 7.2 unemployment, who was reelected was St. Ronnie of Raygun.
Yes, the president with who could claim the most scandals of any late model president we've had.
There, yes. But, you know, he greased his hair up real good and tucked in his turkey neck and came out and told us, well, it's, Mommy, it's morning in America because there's a city on a hill.
Yeah, and how's that astrology thing working out there? What should we do today? God, what a maniac. All right.
Yeah, what a gang of maniacs. Reverbo, you have a good night, brother.
Okay, take care. Make it personal as usual.
As ever. Bye now.
Goodbye.
And that is our op-ed columnist from A Cavalcade of Crazy at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. That is none other than the inimitable Reverbo. About a quarter to the hour, and we will continue the conversation. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, what's up?
Well, I just want to touch base with you, and I'm just getting kind of excited seeing all publicity that the last one is getting these days.
It's getting a ton, and Bobby Kennedy Jr. is doing a fantastic job of going around the country and talking it up.
He sure is. You know, I think we all your listeners can do their little part in their message boards or calls to talk radio or on Facebook. I just posted the link to Kennedy's appearance last night on the Colbert Report, which was quite good. And I missed it, but apparently the League of Conservation Voters picked up on it, and they've been passing it around. You know, it's just such a battle to... you know, what are our minds? What's the public mind going to be focused on? Is it going to be, you know, fill in the blank, the latest sex scandal?
Wienergate.
Yes, it so often has something to do with someone's sexuality. You know, this Puritan nation loves bringing that stuff up. Follow the bouncing balls. Well, take
oh.
And DC for
Preston,
you.
It's been a long time since you won a toaster.
So to speak, but are we going to get real about, you know, our responsibilities as citizens, as parents, you know, as people who have other concerns?
And you are, of course, the Horn's resident optimist. What do you think the odds are of America having that sort of sober intervention come to grips with reality moment?
Well, in some ways it's happening, you know, some people are so French and some infancies, I'm never going to let it go.
Okay, hey, Preston, I'm going to have to ask you to stand by for just a minute. We're having bandwidth issues here. You're breaking up a little bit. I think I can fix it. I'm going to put you back on hold. I'm going to play some music, and I'll be right back, okay?
Sounds.
Stand by. Oh, this is just silly. But no, this is how it works out. We'll take a little just a very brief break, and come right back to our conversation with Preston. You can get in line for the conversation as well, of course. I hope you know that. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Like I said, this won't take very long at all. I'm just going to play a little song real quick. I don't know, well, if you were listening last night, you heard a magnificent song by a man named Hayes Carl, H-A-Y-E-S-C-A-R-L-L, and Michael, also known from time to time as Kid A from the chat room, sent me another piece of his work. And this is a guy whose albums I think I need to own. I don't know about you, but I do. Listen very carefully to these lyrics, will you? Because I think you're going to like it. This is The Horn. We'll be right back. Okay, that was a bad idea, so I'm going to play something that doesn't involve using bandwidth. Stand by. Here we go. A little something from Jason Isbell.
Tell your folks the truth.
get that problem sorted out pretty quick. Teenagers. Really, how long have I been doing this? Okay, so let's go back now that we can have a good conversation with Preston. Preston, I hope you're still there.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, bless your heart for sticking around.
No problem. And likewise, thank you for sticking around through all the work of doing this show. I can only imagine the technical difficulties, the lack of financial support, the barbs, the everything. I can only imagine. And so, and thank
yeah, let's not forget about the rain in the bedroom too. While we're if we're going to list all this stuff. The failed septic system last summer. Oh, it's just, I don't know. There's that old joke about the point of life is not to end it with a well-maintained corpse, but rather to slide into the dirt sideways with a cigar in one hand and a martini in the other, screaming, "What a ride!"
Sounds good. Yes, definitely. And thanks to your supporters. I know you've had a lot of good supporters out there, too, and hopefully picking up some new ones along the way. You know, I'm still not quite sure if my hopefully recurring donation...
Oh, no PayPal contribution recurs. I don't know if PayPal's broken, the widget's broken. We're pretty sure the widget's not broken, and PayPal keeps swearing they're not either.
Okay, well, but... I'll send... another donation your way.
Thank you very kindly.
But we were talking about, you know, are people going to, you know, wake up to some realities and maybe move on some of those realities? And, you know, I think some people won't. We have the human psyche has a, you know, power to delude itself, and we're encouraged to be deluded sometimes. You know, that's what Sean Hannity and so many others, you know, they're there to tell people sweet lies about how everything's okay.
And you know, from a psychological standpoint, and of course the authority on this would be horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, but he's been pretty busy lately. But from a psychological standpoint, I would love to know someday, Preston, what evolutionary reason does the human ability to self-delude serve? You know, that we have that big brain, so we're curious, so we do things like mastering fire so that we can stave off the darkness and not get eaten by the jackals in the night. You know, it makes sense. We have a fight or flight proclivity with endorphin rushes and adrenaline surges and things like that, and you certainly understand that too. But where, Preston, where does this deep-seated desire of the human race to tell itself lies come from?
I think it might be a fear or a stress management deal going on. There's a psychoanalyst, I think, Eric Fromm. He wrote a book called The Anatomy of Human Destruction or something like that. I think he touches on some of the issues. I think one of the patterns that's taken place in human societies has been when an elite, powerful elite has gained power, people have been frightened of them. And what?
I think back to I believe it was Coleridge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, much vaunted laudanum addict of the early 19th century, and poet, who coined the phrase, the willing suspension of disbelief. And, you know, when you're talking about theater or in that age, poetry or literature, then all the way down to our age with music and film, in order for something to be meaningful for you, you have to be able to suspend your native desire to say, this is all BS, this is not real. And theoretically, at least from that, you know, going all the way back to the days of the ancient Greeks and so forth, what comes out of that is that we gain insight into larger truths. There's that dangerous word again. But I guess it has a really disturbing dark side, and that is that our ability to willingly suspend disbelief also allows us to live in one situation while wholly convincing ourselves that it is another. You know, whether it's an idiot like me buying his Powerball ticket twice a week, you know, sitting there being having lost your job and thinking somehow it's going to be okay. I saw some study coming out of, I believe, the UK, and a book last week about the human proclivity for hope.
Okay.
And the psychologist there made the argument that we have to be able to, even in the face of the worst times, we have to be able to hope that it's going to get better, because we do not have, you know, just like we don't have the ability to see in the dark like a cat, or to use our noses against the ground to sniff out food like a dog, we don't have the ability to live with negative reality for very long periods of time without coming completely unglued.
Yeah. And yeah, there's just so many factors. You know, how does a particular society view illness? You know, is it defined as a devil inside of you, or you're a sinner and therefore this has befallen you, or is there a different view on what's going on? Or is it something systematic? Are you living in a toxic society? You know, there are people in power who don't want us to even think about stuff like that. Are these pesticides and herbicides and all that causing us problems? They'd much rather us think it's just something, you know, maybe something you're doing personally or whatever. Bad luck, whatever. Move along. Don't question the system. You know, death. Is that...
Well, consider a mountaintop remover family. They have to live in a fantasy land 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with, you know, reality just sort of creeping around the corners of their existence. Mm-hmm. You know, something just out of their peripheral vision.
Yeah.
Because if they sit down and think about, never mind what they're doing to the rest of us, if they sit down and think about what they're doing, you know, to the new baby in the cradle, I guess their existence becomes wholly intolerable, doesn't it, Preston?
Yeah, and that's what so many of the telepreachers, you know, they feed upon that stuff, providing a kind of a false comfort. But again, back to perspectives on kind of life and some of the hard stuff of life, like how is death perceived? And that can be used to frighten the hell out of people, or it can be used to kind of understand or to enjoy living a little bit more, appreciate it a little bit more. That's why I think 6 Feet Under, that TV show on HBO a couple of years back, was so radical, because it brought death out of the closet and it looked at it in a mature way. And there's one episode of that show where one of the characters hands Nate, one of the main characters, a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, that Buddhist monk, called something like No Death, No Fear, or something like that. And it was kind of a Buddhist perspective on death and dying and how they see it as life enduring and just, you know, things taking different forms. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. My brother, actually, before he died, he suggested that people turn into clouds. And maybe that's a sort of wishful thinking, but on the other hand, physics tells us we are all connected to this stuff.
Yeah,
they're very much from the soil, of the soil, you know, from the dust.
And of course, one of the best to ever enunciate that in large was Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Who drew that line all the way from the Big Bang to Preston. And that's one of those that just mind-boggling when you think about it, that there is literally stuff because all matter came from the Big Bang. And so the matter that is Preston, the matter that is Bob, the matter that is all of us, is literally from the Big Bang itself.
Yeah.
So how are we, you know, how are we not inexorably tied to the universe?
Yep. You know, Einstein said something similar about how this notion of our separateness is kind of an optical illusion. He was also one of the most famous advocates of socialism. So, you know, there, it's that separateness that they can get us very frightened and, you know, put us in a very vulnerable and weak position to hear hard news like a climate catastrophe unfolding and, you know, a whole range of environmental things going on in addition to...
My heavenly days. I woke up this morning, Preston, and they're showing tornado footage, and I'm like, oh, God, did Oklahoma get hit again? It was Western Massachusetts.
Right, right, right.
They don't have those. I mean, they don't even have the right accent for tornadoes.
I remember last year when we did not have a big hurricane season, you know, Limbaugh kept saying, aha, you know, proof that Gore and everybody, they're all wrong. What he failed to mention was that they had a record cyclone season on the other half of the globe. I guess at the southern hemisphere, it's cyclones. In the north, it's
right.
Hurricanes. You know, we had a record tornado season about 4 years ago, and this one has totally blown that record out of the water.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right, right. So, but, you know, in community, with a sense of togetherness and you know, connection, people feel a little bit more at ease and feel a little bit more strength, and they get to share ideas. And I think that's where some of our awakening and moving forward and progressing can take place. And we can start any number of adaptations, the renewables, the, you know, just designing communities.
But, you know, the thing that balances against that, Preston, is, and I, you know, I've had this tab up on my screen for a week now because I keep going back and reading it and reading it and reading it. This Chris Hedges column, The Sky Really Is Falling.
I just posted that myself on my Facebook page, yeah. Yeah, I noticed he noted how in Chicago they're planting trees. The horticulturalists are planting these trees. I forget the name of them, but they're
swamp oaks and sweet gums.
There you go, because they're anticipating a climate more like Baton Rouge than the typical Windy City climate. And then McKibben saying, you know, that's good that they're moving on it, but they're also moving on kind of the older information that wasn't as drastic as, you know, what we're seeing unfold. But again, it's a sign of a growing awareness. When people learn about that, they're getting more aware. And, you know, is it going to be enough? You know, who knows? That, I don't know. But at least we're getting beyond, some of us are getting beyond the narratives of the fossil fuel industry, which is so massive. You know, that's another thing we're up against.
Right? And one of the things that Hedges brings up, of course, Preston, is what he calls the false price of human adaptability to global warming.
That too.
And again, that's something that traces right back to ExxonMobil, to Royal Dutch Shell, to BP, to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, to the Federation of American Coal and Energy Security. You know, the same group that wanted to force feed a bunch of lies to fourth graders about, you know, how important coal is for Merca. And you know what? Like I said last night, we put that one in the win column because Scholastic was so deluged with people absolutely infuriated.
Yeah.
By the idea that they would take part in lying to children.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll take that victory. You know, are we going to win this bigger war? You know, I don't know. But we have these victories along the way. I'll take it for sure. So what else? Yeah, are we going to adapt? Yeah, who knows? I mean, then we've got the whole issue with the acidification of the oceans. I think McKibben mentioned that as well,
mm-hmm.
that there's heat being stored in the oceans and the coral reefs are dying. And it's you could make a really good argument that in some ways we're past a tipping point.
Because I'm a guy who was raised on a big old whopping dose of science fiction, I keep looking around going, you know what, we might want to get that terraforming Mars plan a little bit. We might want to bring that one on the front burner because we're running. Because what we're doing is, and again, it's ultimately the greatest source of frustration, Preston, is the fact that people of knowledge and people who want knowledge understand what's going on, and we are getting our butts whipped by dumb people.
Yeah, that's annoying for sure, but well-heeled, you know, that huge concentration of wealth that they've got.
And well-heeled, well-funded, and as Reverbo says, well-chumped.
Yeah, and some of them are smart in a way. I mean, they're, you know, like a Fox, clever, Machiavelli.
Oh, sure. Look at the Discovery Institute out in Seattle. Jude and I were talking about that the other night. The Discovery Institute out in Seattle that has a budget in excess of $5 million a year, and their sole goal is to try to roll back actual science. I mean, we've seen this happen in human history before. What happens when cultures abandon knowledge? Well, they become, you know, the culture collapses. You know, you've got the great inward turning of the Chinese Empire after having sent out the treasure fleets and maybe even discovered the New World. If you buy into that argument, and it's a little ancient astronauty, but still, it's interesting that where they did get to is stunning. And lo and behold, the treasure fleets got home. The great Khan had died. There was a new guy in charge, and he said, uh-uh. And China turned in upon itself, and all of the technology that they had developed was lost. And you can look at the fall of the Roman Empire. Here comes the church. There goes the technology. Next thing you know, you've got a millennium of Monty Python skits of people. Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here. You know, the serfs mucking in the goo.
Well, the Roman Empire fell, but look at Italy now. It's a great place to be.
Well, you know, the ship that
cafes, good wine.
Absolutely, the ship we traversed the Caribbean on was Italian built, and I got to say, it was a dandy. Just a beautiful, and you know, who doesn't want a Ferrari or a Lamborghini? Or, well, I don't. You have to, you know, work on them for every mile you drive. You work on them for 3 hours. But I'm being a smartass.
Yeah, yeah. So the notion of some civilizations collapsing, I think, it's going to be a bumpy ride for sure. But ultimately, they come around in interesting ways. You know, the Black Plague, people saw that as the cataclysm, the apocalypse, the end of everything, but the life force kind
of... But it turned out to be the birth of the Renaissance because it empowered the poor to take control of their labor as against the people who believed that God had made them special because they were royal. So you get a rising merchant class, you get a traveling class. The influence of the church slowly, mercifully begins to wane.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the peak oil and peak other resource people. You know, it's not all doom and gloom at all. They see all sorts of opportunities. And again, are they the sort of adaptations that are going to save us, save the world? I don't know, but. There's the sort of adaptations that can make their lives, you know, enrich them for as many years or months or whatever that we have left. I mean, it's amazing that we're even still here, that we're still around with, you know, all these decades that we've been on hair trigger alert with thousands of nuclear weapons all over the place, and, you know, not just the Cuban Missile Crisis, but the several occasions where we've had, you know, face down the Soviet Union or actually.
And we've always got some right winger saying, you know what we need to do? We need to drop about 100 kiloton device right smack dab on top of that black rock they got over there in Mecca.
Right, right. Yeah, well, we had Tom Tancredo, I think, was, you know, Colorado.
Yeah, that was one of his.
Yeah, yeah. You know, again, the delusion, I think that's the greater delusions coming from figures like that. I mean, very frightened people like that who are, they're enriching themselves, you know. People are very frightened, how are you going to make a living? And whether it's, you know, you're in a coal economy or a weapons economy, how are people going to rationalize what they're doing that they know in a larger sense is destructive, but on a smaller sense is going to, you know, get them a nice car and get their house paid for and all that stuff.
Well, you know, Preston, you'll appreciate this. I didn't get to it last night, but I got an email from our buddy Robert over in Kitakyushu, Japan. And he said, unique or not, of divine origin or not, Japan's native character and traditional virtues are on a global display as pre-Quake its manga and anime characters were. The world is surprised, impressed, and even awed. Sometimes this sentiment comes from quite unexpected quarters. The example of China, hardly predisposed in Japan's favor, has already been mentioned. Another reported by the Asahi Shimbun earlier this month is an ongoing Japan boom in, says Robert, of all places, Saudi Arabia. And this is a fascinating story. He says it began 2 years ago and therefore is not rooted in the catastrophe, but it celebrates the same virtues with which the world has lately become familiar. They were exposed to a Saudi audience, writes the Asahi's Middle East and Africa Bureau Chief Tsutomu Ishii, by a TV reporter for a popular variety news program. Among the surprising eye-openers, and this is surprising eye-openers for Saudi people, okay? Japanese children clean their own classrooms, the sort of chore which in Saudi Arabia is contemptuously fobbed off on foreign menials. Further, the Japanese are honest. To prove it, the Saudi reporter left a wallet full of money in a Tokyo park. Sure enough, a couple with a child in tow found the wallet and promptly brought it to a police box. That would not likely have happened in Saudi Arabia, apparently. And Ishii quotes the Saudi reporter as being led to this surprising conclusion, and this is a quote. It's beautiful. In Saudi Arabia, Islam is considered the loftiest religion. And yet it seems that the country that best embodies the Holy Quran's core values of sincerity and cleanliness is one with no connection to Islam at all, Japan. I take away from that is that there are ways to survive.
Yeah, and you know, to be fair to the people, the regular people in the Middle East, I remember that Andrew Zimmern, I think he was in Syria, and they ran out of gas, and some guy came along on his motorcycle and went back in the other direction from where he needed to be, but got him a tank of gas, came back, refused to take any money from them. And Zimmern was just blown away by the generosity of people, and he says that over and over, and I'm sure he runs into, you know, some not so great situations and moods and people's stuff too, but generally he's pretty impressed by the species. And I think that's what we all need to wake up to every day. I mean, we all get in our funks and our despair, and you know, we know the ways in which we aren't out there in the best ways ourselves, but I think if we keep looking around for it, we're going to find the better parts of the species. And
if some parts of the species will just get out of the way.
You know, I don't think they're going to, you know. I think they're real entrenched, and again, they've got so much money, and but I cannot keep up with all the good groups that I'm finding out there. Like I just mentioned, the League of Conservation. Mm-hmm.
Look at these two itsy bitsy teeny tiny little groups that destroyed Cole's plans to poison 4-year-olds' minds. They were tiny groups.
There's that. There was what Tom Hartman is doing on a huge scale, and he connected with Robert Kennedy earlier this week. So there's that whole audience that's aware of that movie. I was at the Last Mountain website just now, and we're getting these new technologies. It's like so much of the stuff that we need. Like if we need to network more, if we need to communicate more, we're being provided these tools. You know, Facebook comes out of somewhere, then tweeting comes up. You know, and it gets misused or used in silly ways. Okay, yeah, but it's also being used in very productive ways. And I'm seeing how people are tweeting on the Last Mountain website about how can we get a screening of the film here, and you know, all sorts of information where you can see it, and some guy writing in from Norway about how, when's the DVD going to be available?
Yeah, and consider it's going to be screened for the first time for the public in West Virginia Friday, the 10th of June, and then 7 days later, it will be screened at Netroots Nation in Minneapolis. And I think the Netroots Nation screening is going to be huge. Because you've got, you know, hopefully a lot of people will come to see it. You've got thousands of people milling around looking for something to write about. And the one nice thing that this film makes clear is that this is a seminal issue, a crossroads issue for the American people at this point in time.
And I'm sure there are many people in other parts of the world that are like, have an eye on it. You know, we are more interconnected in that way. I mean, people in China are seeing their environment devastated. But, you know, they're advocating for more solar. People in Colombia, I was just listening to a talk by Vandana Shiva, that incredible physicist and environmentalist in India. And she is seeing so much destruction. But, you know, she has some great, you know, stories, some archetypical, some mythological stories to dig into to keep her spirit and her energy going. And she was talking about Shakti, kind of this feminine creativity goddess, and also a destroyer of, you know, false idols. And so, you know, maybe some of the false idols of, you know, the CEOs of Massey. Well, I guess it's Alpha now.
Right.
Massey changed its name to...
well, they were assimilated by Borg.
Cyborg.
Alpha being the Borg in this instance. Preston, okay. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
You know, there's so much more, but we'll pick it up again soon, and I look forward to hearing what your other listeners have to say. And and let me make sure I've got that website right for The Last Mountain.
Yes.
The Last Mountain.
.org, I think. Here, let me check real quick. Won't take but a second.
It's okay. We're all checking it.
And let's see. Lots of, lots of reviews. Maybe IMDb will have the link to the website.
Okay. And if, you know, if some of your listeners have some stuff they want to put out there into the world, into the public mind, there's another ally on the...
Holy cow, I got to tell you this, Preston. This is so funny.
Okay.
On the IMDb site. you know, I'm in the movie for like 2.5 seconds.
You know, I was going to ask you about that. Excellent.
But here's the funny part. On the IMDb site, there are two trailers you can click. And you know how when you put up a trailer on the internet, it just grabs some frame somewhere in the film?
Yeah. You're there?
I'm on the IMDb site. Oh, cool. I'm going to have my IMDb. I'll have to set up my IMDb page now.
Right on.
Vanity. Great. All is vanity. But
hey, a better image of you than Blankenship or whoever, you know?
Well, hear. I got to say, I'm not better looking than many people on Earth, but I'm a lot better looking than Don Blankenship on my worst day.
A much more beautiful soul, for sure.
Thank you, Preston. You have a good night.
You too.
Bye now. I didn't know that. That's just funny. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Well, listen, I'm wondering... how is it that this Mr. Dyett of Yuma, Arizona, was married 5 damn times, and he's 73 and decided he would just kill up everybody and then shoot himself? You hear about this?
No, what?
Oh, yeah, well, five people are dead in Arizona, a rampage. This man shot a lawyer. I don't know if he shot some women, but he's 73. Been divorced, is over some divorce. This is his fifth divorce. And I'm like, damn. I mean, I'm not against people marrying and divorcing, but you would think that the number four wife would have been a bit wondering, huh?
Well, maybe a little bit. Oh, my God, yeah.
I'm going to trivialize it, but I'm like, damn, you know, people can't handle their business without killing folks first. I'm so sick of it. Just shoot yourself if it's that bad. But leave us and everybody.
Yeah, leave everybody else out of it.
Leave the women out of it. The poor lawyer. Come on now. Four people.
But you know, we've got a culture, Sandra, that says it's okay to kill lawyers.
Well, that's crazy. Yeah, I don't know. Arizona is definitely on edge. It's a very ugly, hateful state, and I think it just breathes. I'm sorry.
Well, I think, and it's beginning to boil, because the other side of this coin is that the recall effort for that god awful Senate President Pierce.
Oh, right. Yes, I heard about
they needed 7,000 signatures.
They got doubled up in there.
They got 18,000 and some. And of course, you know, the Pierce is a neo-Nazi.
He is. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, well, there goes Bob calling people names again. He just loves calling. No. This guy really is a Nazi.
No, that definitely is fitting. But anyway, it's interesting that. Yeah, so what do you take away from that? That is double.
Well, there's going to be trouble, because the other side on this answered back. Let's see, I've got it right here. Answered back along the lines of, well, we're not going to allow ourselves to be intimidated by radical leftists and anarchists and out-of-state agitators. When you're using, I mean, come on, we've heard this before. The last time we heard out-of-state agitators, three civil rights workers wound up in an earthen dam, Sandra.
That's like another more whistle words, you know, for the fiends out there happy to take out, you know, the lefties and other people of color and on and on and on. You're right about that. So, basically, Arizona, with its gun hiding, guns everywhere, you can go anywhere with a gun. It's scary. That is scary.
And the thing is, remember when you sent me the story about the trial of the two New York cops who raped the woman?
Well, you know what? Yes, and that, you know, I'm scared. Yeah.
Well, there was sort of a bookend to that of a sick sort. In regard to something that happened fairly recently in Arizona.
What's that?
And that's the two tours of duty Iraq vet who had people coming through his door, so he hid his wife and child, got his AR-15, stood in the hallway, the darkened hallway. Somebody comes barreling through. He's got the safety on. It is his firearm is not cocked and locked. And the Mesa County, no, not Mesa, the whatever county Tucson's in, the police department SWAT team put 69 rounds through him in 7 seconds.
What?
And they were they said they were executing a drug search warrant.
Oh.
No drugs, no history of drugs, clean as a pin, and of course the police department will walk on it because of the holding from U.S. v. Leon that says, well, you know, as long as they were acting in good faith.
Yeah, good faith. The never-ending benefit of the doubt that these fiends get as they militarize every police station up and down this.
And you know there's an expansion on that today or in the last day or so, right?
Oh, well, what more can they do? What are they doing now?
Well,
armored personnel?
No, Crisco John Ashcroft just got a pass. A guy who was detained by the FBI and imprisoned on a claim of material witness, sued, and it went to the Supreme Court, and in four separate opinions, they cobbled together enough of a majority to say that Crisco John Ashcroft is immune. And this is the fascinating part. The guy, his name is Al Kidd. He's an American citizen, you know, kind of like Mr. Al Awlaki. An American citizen,
right.
Only this guy still lives in the U.S. He's an American citizen. He converted to Islam. He's a former college football player. He was arrested in 2003 as a material witness in a terrorism case in Idaho. He was never called as a witness. The person on trial in that case was acquitted. All the way through the process, Al-Kid cooperated with the FBI, answered their questions. They never even had to waterboard him. All of the questioning and cooperation came before he was arrested. They never accused him of doing anything wrong whatsoever. So here's the holding from the Supreme Court. You're just going to love this, Sandra. Held. The objectively reasonable arrest and detention of a material witness pursuant to a validly obtained warrant cannot be challenged as unconstitutional on the basis of allegations that the arresting authority had an improper motive. Now, what's fascinating out of that, though, is the Supreme Court did not rule that John Ashcroft had a proper motive. They didn't hold that he didn't have an improper motive. They just said too bad.
Well, so, but this just sort of adds to the ability of the upcoming police state, because of the pending economic collapse, can just hold people.
Right.
I mean, that's what that falls under.
Sure it does.
Any reason to hold anybody, and all federal officials, especially powerful ones, will never be held to account. This is, go back to the Star Chamber, Divine Right of Kings.
I got one more funsie for you. Justice Kagan absented herself from the case. Guess why?
Oh, why?
Because she had argued as Solicitor General on behalf of John Ashcroft's actions in the lower court.
Yeah, of course she did. I mean, that woman is going to stay. She's going to stay recused, from what I can tell, on any civil liberty type cases, because she has argued for the government nonstop. So, but it's really scary for us basic Joe citizens out here, you know, what's pending to me. I'm sorry to keep, you know, trying to look at it in a big picture way, but these little bites that they're taking out all adds up to controlling a desperate population, because there's no more economic opportunity.
Right, so we'll just warehouse the people who prove to be trouble?
Well, I'm just saying, it's just, you know, people don't realize how important those sort of rights are. You know what I mean?
Well, and I'm not asking a smart aleck question. This is very serious. Is habeas corpus still all screwed up?
Yeah.
I think it is.
That's up to grabs, and once again, you know, all this stuff will be applied differently, and that's what destroys the whole idea of America if the basis is that we look to laws to sort things out. If we're not looking to laws anymore, then what do we have?
And see, that's why it felt to me, as I was going through stories this evening, it felt to me like there was kind of a line that ran between that Supreme Court case about John Ashcroft not even needing a proper motive in order to avoid suit, and in the meantime, you know, a hooker in the South Bronx gets convicted of conspiracy to commit prostitution or whatever, because she's got some of the city's free condoms in her purse.
Well, yeah, but see, yeah, this just goes to the sort of a free pass on powerful officials, and it's a brutal, punitive state that we have for us, and it's getting worse and worse. I mean, all these sort of data lists that different states are trying to get, not for sex offenders anymore, but for murderers, and I'm not saying that, you know, that's a good, you know, that murdering is good, but they want to have a database available to list anybody who's committed any crime. So you see how that's creeping?
Yeah, it was a long time ago when the babies were little, and the state police would set up these little protect your children booths at the county fair and stuff. You'd walk up with the precious pumpkin, and they'd fingerprint him. And then they'd take out a little test tube and a little cotton swab and run it around his little mouth and stuff it in there and label it. So the state now has God knows untold thousands of DNA samples of perfectly law-abiding toddlers who are by now law-abiding, we hope, teenagers.
Well, Speaking of that, I think it's interesting that the ACLU, I guess they're jumping into this Florida business,
right?
You know, on the basis of the state just can't handle and demand fluids and bodily whatevers. You know, it's a blatant violation, you know, of the Fourth Amendment. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, is there any way they can get a stay on that?
I think the stay was, no, the whole reason that the thing's going into effect is because the stay was denied.
Oh, by what court? You don't know. It's all right.
Well, you know, trial court jurisdiction in the state of Florida.
Yeah. No, well, and is there any other, I don't know. I don't know why this is just really doing my head in, that whole business down there, because I don't understand how it can.
Well, and here's the fun part. I got a little more research from David in Tennessee last night. It was Jim who pointed out that there's all kinds of substances out there that you can use innocuously that will make it look like your pee is dirty.
Right. No, exactly. No, that's right on.
So Jim pointed that out, right. And then David in Tennessee turned around and also pointed out that the way it works with Governor Unindicted Co-Conspirator's company there is that it takes about 90 days to turn around the refund. So,
of course it does.
You know, so it's a reality. Let's say mommy and daddy are living together in the same house. Well, they've both got to pee. And so that's $140. And that's $140 for a power bill or for a water bill.
It's 70 per test?
That's the upward end of the spectrum.
Oh, no, I thought it was like $35.
No. Up to 70.
Oh, you know, how is it up to anything? Why does it vary?
Well, it depends. I think it depends on how many substances they test for.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, that is just police state, horrible state overreaching. Oh, my God. I'm sorry. It's horrible. It is, and considering that this cretin made all his money, you know, in the medical industry, too, all of it is just really, it's so disgusting. Next thing you know, he's some sort of eugenicist, and he'll be sterilizing them next. I'm serious.
Well, don't think that the idea hasn't probably run through his head.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's the mindset. But the other thing that's really killing me is, no, that man did not get that law, the labor law thing. My God. I mean, is it just because people are stupid? There's a reason that we have going to school instead of working. And at 8% unemployment, you don't need more laborers unless you just want to drive wages all the way down and keep kids from having opportunities in education. That's the only reason for doing this.
Well, consider who put them in office. You know, you ask, are people stupid? These are teabagger candidates, Sandra.
Oh, my God. No, but see, the thing about it is I don't think people understand how difficult it was to get this shit pulled back in the first place, and they're just giving it away. And what, we're supposed to sit around and think, oh, okay, well, when some Democrats get in, we'll get that back. That's not how it works.
No.
All these laws were not, you know, the electoral process.
It is twice as hard to remove a law as it is, if not three times as hard, to remove a law as it is to pass one.
And not only that, but these laws were agitated through mass social movement. I don't see one. The Wisconsin is a good example. It's like those people relented, and it's just turned into, oh, we'll deal with it through the electoral process.
Yeah, but have you seen the latest on that? You know, there's six Wisconsin senators who are facing recall.
Yeah, I saw that.
So, guess what the Republican Party's doing?
Challenging it somehow?
Well, no. It's much simpler just to engage in typical Republican dirty tricks. Now, I may get some of this wrong, Sandra, so, you know, in fairness. But the way I understand it works out is it's a head-to-head winner-take-all. If it's just this guy versus one candidate, or, you know, the recalled candidate versus another candidate.
What are they trying to get?
But if there are two Democrats in the contest, there has to be a primary first.
So that gives Citizens United money longer to work, because you've got to have a primary before you can have a general.
Well, why would they?
And
have
so the Republican Party, an acolyte, an actual former minion of Rents Priebus, is out there casting a wide net, trying to recruit Democrats to run in every one of these contests.
Right. Well, you mean so?
As to create a primary, so as to expand the electoral season, so as to maximize the efficiency of Citizens United money. And by the way, not just Wisconsin. David in Tennessee told me just a little bit ago, this is a beautiful thing. The proud Republican governor in Tennessee just today signed into law that corporations can contribute directly to candidates in Tennessee. They don't even have to cycle it through the PACs anymore.
And then, of course, that's going to be challenged right away, isn't it?
Sure, but don't look for it. It ain't going to be overturned in Tennessee.
Well, no, but I mean, so whatever law they enact in Tennessee is just law? I mean, no one will challenge it?
Well, no, it'll be challenged. But there's no court. I mean, they don't have a functioning court system to overturn it.
Well, no. What I mean, though, it will be enacted for this coming election. That's what I'm trying to ask.
It'll certainly be on the books, barring some sort of injunction. It'll be on the books for the 12th cycle.
Well, have you seen this sort of news that, people are kind of looking to see if that Ryan's going to run for president? Can you even believe it?
Oh,
and
God.
And I'm thinking, well, here's the fascist face for the fascist state that's being created. This fool is getting credit for challenging Obama. You know, he's going to give us foreign policy speech, and that's why people are thinking he might be considering it. And the foreign policy speech that he's giving is stating that in order for the U.S. to maintain its hegemony, the entitlements must be cut. I am serious.
Oh, my God. I'm surprised he's not calling for every state, every nation state with health care for its citizens to abandon communism.
Well, you know, but this man is going to seriously get on the so-called world stage and announce that in order for America to become fully Romanized, you know, we need to end any kind of safety net for the people. But that bitch, he need to read up on his empire history, because we need bread and circus.
No, he doesn't need to do that, because he's got Atlas Shrugged.
Okay,
that's all he needs.
No, but they're an idiot, though. They can't even run the fascist regime right, because what is he planning on doing with all these people who are in complete misery after he destroys the safety net?
Well, if they get all uppity, I will refer you to the John Ashcroft case we discussed a few moments ago.
Oh, listen, I know it's one big horrible circle, isn't it? I don't know. I'm just sort of sick, because his face is getting to me, and he just has to breathe, and you have, like, a huge amount of reporting on this freak and how he's interacting in the world, like telling Obama whatever, what's what. And it's just like, huh? And Obama is sort of telling the Democrats who want him to be more forceful, oh, no, I can't do that. Don't expect any, strong language from the Oval Office. That was Obama's message.
And see, every time I mention a little Eddie Munster Ryan, I immediately mention the fact that this guy got through college on Social Security survivor's benefits.
And it should be mentioned nonstop every time.
Right. Why did that story just kind of trickle by?
Exactly. You know, because they're all hypocrites. But they're going to constantly see, the reason why it's not resonating, though, as much as they want it to, is because people can see, wait a minute, you know, you've completely bailed out everybody under the sun, you got wars all over the world, and now you're going to come to us and say we need to give up the safety net? People aren't buying it, that's what I'm saying. But there's no mechanism here for it to be actualized, so... You know, like you always say, you know, there ain't going to be no revolution.
And I wish I was wrong, but I really don't, I don't think I am.
But I'm just saying that the you know, they're really trying to do a hard sell, you know, telling people that this is going to be beneficial. Obviously, it isn't. You know,
well,
you know,
like I said, I thought I was just going to come loose from reality the other day when I saw that Groupon business.
Oh no, that's not real, is it?
Where he suggested the use of. I desperately hope it's not, but I saw an attributed quote.
Wow, yeah. No. I mean, it's interesting to see how they expect for people to sign on to making their lives worse. You know what I'm saying? I'm curious. But anyway, I'll let you go. But I did read that article from Harris Perry.
Yeah.
And that was interesting, and it's the same kind of thing across the board with the they all look alike syndrome. And
well, why is it that white people can disagree all over the place?
Yeah.
But if members of the black community aren't just rock solid all together, that suddenly all the white folks go, well, see, they're not holding up their end of the bargain.
Yeah, well, I like her using the Ralph Ellison, because I forgot about that book. It's been so long.
I hadn't thought of it either, and suddenly it all just came roaring back, and I went, oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was deep. Well, listen, I got to let you go.
But, all right, take care, Sandra, and good luck with the mixdown.
Oh, God, yes, that's going pretty well. All right.
All right, cool, see ya. Bye now. Oh, and by the way, another little bit of fun, I played that Jason Isbell tune a little bit ago, and it refers to several different photos here and there. I thought of that because of the whole reference to little snapshots of America. One more little snapshot of America for you. Because it's just, well, we can't walk away from this. Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who was flown to his son's high school baseball game in a disaster preparedness, homeland security, New Jersey purchased multi-million-dollar helicopter. Well, he's after Medicaid. And he is proposing to lower the levels of maximum income in New Jersey for Medicaid eligibility. Get this, just dig this gap. Right now, the maximum level of income you can have in New Jersey and still get Medicaid is $24,645. A laughably small number in and of its own right. Chris Christie has proposed. Now sit down. Chris Christie has proposed that maximum eligibility number be reduced to $5,317 per year. That's almost $20,000 lower for a family of three, mommy, daddy, precious baby. If a family of three makes $6,000 a year in Chris Christie world, they're too rich for Medicaid. Just dig that. That's one-third of the poverty level. One individual cited said, an uninsured parent working full-time at a minimum wage job would not be eligible. A parent who works half-time for minimum wage wouldn't even qualify. The only way parents could become eligible for health coverage through Medicaid in the future is if the parent applies for and is eligible for welfare. That's it. And they're not eligible for welfare if they're making $24,000 a year. See how it works? Now, the fact of the matter is, those 23,000 people are very real human beings. Because that's how many people will be kicked off the Medicaid rolls in New Jersey under the Chris Christie austerity plan.
23,000 people. Chris Christie is telling 23,000, many of them working adults in New Jersey, to go die. To go die. Is that enough to get people out in the street in New Jersey? I fear for what I think is the answer. Because you know what? The poor and the working poor can't get time off to go demonstrate. They got to keep working or they die anyway. It's a choice between dying of untreated illness and the choice of dying the slow, miserable death of starvation and watching it happen to your whole family. How about those right-wing Republican family values? How about that culture of life? Goya. Goya. 2 in tomorrow. We'll find out if anybody, we'll find out if the pitchforks and torches have come out in Trenton. I, for one, will not hold my breath. Sorry, won't do it. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Jim.
Well, the legal mechanism is already in place. Ad hoc law.
Yeah, just I guess the fancy hillbilly word for that would be willy-nilly. Just make it up as you go along, right?
Well, that's been done before. It was done during Hitler's Third Reich. I mean, they took any law they wanted to subject to elimination and supplanted it with their own. And that's what these people are doing. That's what ad hoc law is.
In addition to being terrifying, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's terrifying. But that's precisely what it is. I mean, you look at the laws that were passed during that regime.
Well, and bear in mind that that terror aspect is also very much a conscious and intended part of the process. You know, you want ultimately you want cheap labor, and you get cheap labor by scaring the daylights out of working people.
Well, yeah, you create this imaginary golem or boogabear or whatever you want to call it, and then you have the passage of terrible consequences being embodied into the legal system of the state.
And you set up a legal framework that says... we can basically do anything we want, and we can't be touched in civil suit, such as the Supreme Court ruled on. And everything's in place at that point, isn't it, Jim?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, sed lex, dura lex. The law is latex with these people.
I guess it's a rhetorical question. They have no shame. Is there anything they won't touch? I mean, they've gone after Medicare. They've gone after Medicaid. They're going after SCHIP. They've gone after child labor laws. They're going after literally the right of homeless, hungry people to eat. They're going after efforts to prevent New York City from absolutely burning up with HIV and every other sexually transmitted disease. Jim, honest to God, you've got a hell of a lot more perspective than I do. Where does it end?
You know where it ends. It ends in destruction of just about everything that is decent, honorable, and right.
And I guess that's the question I'm asking. What does America look like after the right wing gets the entirety of its wish list accomplished?
It will self-destruct. I've always maintained that these people contain within their own the fabric of their own characters and the work of these characters. One thing, it's just total nihilism. It's just total, you know, the whole fabric just is rent in twain. Logic doesn't apply. There is no logic to these things. It's for this purpose only, and they move from one thing to the other.
So,
the Martians did in War of the Worlds.
Sociologically speaking, is it just a quick slip into outright feudalism and serfdom?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, how long until we bring back ideas of bond servitude?
Well, not long. But I mean, who would have thought that the and I'm going back to, you know, what happened in Hitler's Germany in the 1930s. When you have a law that was passed in September of 1935, you know, against the Jews and racial purity and all the other laws that were passed.
See, I've got this vision, Jim, that's more like 1852.
Well,
because let's just consider for a minute, we've got a couple. Let's consider for a minute what happens in America when the food stamps are gone, when the Medicaid is gone, when Medicare is gone, when Social Security is gone, when the jobs, too, are gone, and your baby is crying with hunger, and somebody with money says, tell you what, I'll build you a little shack out back, and you can move your family in, and I'll see to it you're fed every day as long as you do what I tell you to do. And you can't leave because we've got a contract.
But how long can that stay in place, Bob?
Well, for the people who have the money, indefinitely.
I don't think so. I think that what they're doing is they're destroying the base of the pyramid upon which they themselves are supported. I've always maintained that.
But how many centuries they managed to eke out a pretty nice existence, the Southern planters did, for a couple of hundred years, didn't they?
I'd say two or three, two at the most.
And with these people who don't even think generationally, don't think past next week, these right wing proto Confederates. They're not thinking about 100 years from now. They're thinking about making sure it's okay for them for the rest of their born days.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're very short-sighted.
You know, there's stuff that, for instance, Sandra has mentioned from time to time. There are people out there who are working for free for online companies in exchange for virtual money that they spend to buy in these silly little games that they play. Well, that's another form of bond servitude. It just happens to have the shiny gloss of a cyber existence on it.
Yeah, but the trouble is, I don't think these people can have these games for dinner, can they?
No, but they may be able to trade some online credits for a Groupon to McDonald's.
A Groupon? Is that the latest euphemism?
Well, no, it's a company. They provide the discount coupons and the like.
Is this one of Ryan's creations?
No, it's an internet marketing creation.
Okay, you're beyond me there. I'm not doing it at all.
But what I'm saying is there are things in place that can be used to exploit desperate people. There always are. Hunger is the greatest motivating exploitative tool that the rich have, and they have always had it. And I see I see a very frightening descent into feudalism and bond servitude. And, you know, people can say that, oh, well, you know, I'm just screaming at the sky is falling. But their wish list, Jim, really is to get rid of Social Security, to get rid of Medicaid, to get rid of Medicare, unemployment compensation, temporary aid to needy families, food stamps, everything that benefits the most desperate and fragile in our society, they want to get rid of so that they can take the money that goes into that and give it to themselves.
The prognosis is not good, but I can tell you this, the more quickly they do it, the more quickly will be their own undoing. I know you're running out of time, but that's the only thing I can add.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. You have a good night.
You too.
Bye now. So that's the end of the program for this evening. Sorry we ran out of time, but tune in tomorrow, and we'll have at it again. I really appreciate all of your input. I appreciate the fact that we went from needing 26 contributors to the Thrifty 250 to only needing 19 for tonight. So we'll just carry that over to tomorrow, I suppose. Thank you very much, all of you. Because every penny you send is a sacrifice, and we know it. Thanks to our chat room moderator, Lottie. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Reverbo, our op-ed columnist. John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer. Man of many hats. And thanks to Ben Birch, who makes sure the stream always gets to you and he never sends a bill for it. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and CoalRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.